Good morning. I'm your host, Claudia Shambaugh, welcoming you to the March 12th Pre-Nowruz edition, 2024 edition of Ask a Leader. My guest for the full hour is Suri Farooqnia, a local risk and audit professional and co-founder of Iranian American Democrats of California. Speaking in her capacity as an activist, she has a full roster to cover today, including Iranian American political organizing in general, the Middle Eastern Northern African Inclusion Act, the Temporary Family Visitation Act, and the Allyship Act. All this going into Ramadan and Nowruz. As spring has sprung, civics keeps us on this show. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the show. My guest for the full program is Suri Farooqnia, and she is a risk, thank you, she is a risk and audit professional here at Pacific Life, co-founder of Iranian American Democrats of California, elected delegate to the California Democratic Group, the Democratic Party of Orange County Central Committee member, and the elected Democratic National Committee delegate for the California 45th. I believe it's, well, the 45th should be the 47th pretty soon. Treasurer of Feel the Burn Democratic Club Orange County, women rights activist, and a devoted community organizer and philanthropist. She is also a member of the Language Accessibility Advisory Committee with the Registrar of Voters in Orange County. Suri prioritizes removing barriers to voting, promoting diversity and inclusion, advocating for progressive values, and holding elected officials accountable and accessible to their constituents. Her other affiliations include nearly two decades with both the International Society for Children with Cancer and Keep Children in School. Suri completed her Bachelor's of Science at Oakland University in Accounting and Finance. She comes to us live today from Newport Beach, whereas we had originally planned to do this next week, but it's going to give everybody an extra week to get ready for Nowruz with themes today. She comes to us live, but I had a last-minute postponement. We'll get Samantha on at the middle of April. Well, welcome to Ask a Leader, Suri Farooqnia. Thank you for coming on such short notice.
Good morning, and thank you for having me, and for all those listeners that know what Chaushanba Suri is, happy Chaushanba Suri. Today is the first day of the Nowruz celebration, so it couldn't be any better day to actually start talking about Nowruz.
Bale. Well done. Hele khube. So that, and that's the extent. I can also sign off, but maybe I will do that. So here's how we'll proceed, everybody. We'll do some general demographics, then we'll go into pending state and federal legislation. It's really important. And then we've already started the Nowruz celebration and the Ramadan commemoration. We'll talk about that combination. It's a particular one this year. First, it was a really good encounter with you I had at the Great American Write-In last Saturday. Lots was going on, including your many causes that you wanted folks to write to policymakers about. But first, let's start, Suri, you and I, with there are a good many political organizations established in the U.S. and even in Orange County. Last September 16th was a rally in downtown Los Angeles, the first anniversary of the death, and I have to invoke her name, Mahsa Amini, who she died in police custody now two Septembers ago. We saw an impressive mobilization of Iranian American power at that rally, mainly those turning out, whom are often referred to as royalists, people supporting the return of the Shah's family. So please, Suri, help us understand the difference and draw some distinctions for us between Iranian American organizations in Southern California. Take your time. We all need to be hearing the details, the context, the nuances.
Yes, so obviously there's a lot of non-political organizations, proud to say that most of these organizations were spearheaded by an Iranian woman. And they do philanthropy work, whether it's ISCC charity that helps children with cancer, to several organizations that are focused on education, you know, because education is power. And so if we educate the younger generation, then they will be thriving and they will be pro-democracy and they will not be, hopefully, as easily brainwashed by the powers in the theocracy that really tries to brainwash them or hold them back. So that's the idea. And so there are several organizations, Keep Children in School, one of them that I work very closely with. But there's also Child International, there is Moms Against Poverty, there's More Balanced World, and several other ones. And I apologize if I'm not naming everyone, but they are focused on children and education. But there is also several organizations that have more of a political stand. And so they have, some have come and gone, and some have changed names. And one has so many tentacles that it's hard to keep up which one is which. So I'll go through those because I think those would be of the interest of people. Right. So the one that has many tentacles is originally known as Mujahideen-e Khalq or MEK. They changed name to NCRI. Some people know them as POM. In California, they seem to be busy under the name of Women for Democracy and many other names. And like I said, it's hard to keep up with all the different names that they have. But there's one central thing about them. They all believe that Maryam Rajavi is the, you know, proclaimed president of future of Iran. And it is unfortunate that the power of the bees, whether, and it doesn't matter if it's in U.S., whether they're Republican or Democrats, mostly Republicans, and initially by Republicans, but then there has been some Democrats who have taken a lot of donations from them, and they also promote them so much that there was a Resolution 100 that was introduced in 2023 that got a supermajority, it was HRES 100, got a supermajority sponsorship, over 200 representatives, both sides of the aisle had endorsed it. And while it's on the surface, it seemed like it was supporting the, you know, woman life freedom movement, in fact, it was promoting Maryam Rajavi. There were two whereas statements in there that basically talked about Maryam Rajavi as being, you know, authenticating her as a opposition leader, and plus validating her 10-step plan as being something of the future master plan for Iran. So many, you know, I mean, we at the Iranian American Democrats of California rang the bells right away the day that the resolution came out. But obviously, you know, they're very well connected and well funded. And they already came out with, you know, bipartisan support initially and quickly gathered. And I'm sure many of the representatives who supported it meant well because they wanted to support the Iranian American community and their families and not necessarily be, you know what it means to have Maryam Rajavi in there. So we went on a letter campaign, social media campaign to say either amend this and take the reference to Maryam Rajavi and her 10-step plan out or rescind your support. Well, the resolution never came for a vote, while symbolically had a lot of supporters. It never came to a vote, and so it was never approved in the Congress because of the huge backlash from the Iranian community. And the reason I say this, it's not because I say this from a personal standpoint. It is historic to the extent that the Iranian people in the war that was imposed on Iran, with, unfortunately, U.S. and Germany and other countries supporting Saddam at the time, to impose the 8-year war on Iran.
In the 1980s.
Yes, in the 80s, correct. you know, the Mujahideen who were stationed in the first Ashraf complex in Iraq actually helped Saddam against the people of Iraq. And so the enemy of my enemy is never a friend. That's our mantra, but obviously not for them. And they got into cahoots with people who were bombing and killing people of Iran. And the people of Iran are not going to forgive and forget. And you can also tell very well that last year, in about August time frame in 2023, we did a fundraiser. So there was a community-funded poll of all Iranian-Americans in California. We are a California-based organization. While we pay attention to things that happen, you know, across the country, our focus is mainly on California. Therefore, while an organization called PAYA, that is more nonpartisan, and they're based in D.C., and they have conducted several, every year or every other year, they've done a poll of Iranian Americans across the nation. There had never been a poll specifically in California. And why California matters is because California is the single spot in the world outside of Iran with the highest number of Iranians living. So we believe that, you know, there is a lot of diversity in this state, and it would be a good representation. So if folks wanted to refer to our website, iraniandems.org, you will see the result of that survey. And what you will see is that while there are other organizations that Iranian Americans don't favor, and I can speak about those, one non-Iranian organization is NRA that has very little support in the Iranian community. But MEK/POI/ all the other names that they carry in CRI had an absolute unanimous negative response. There was not even like a 1% support for them. So does that hold them back from, you know, giving donations to the likes of, you know, I mean, having Pompeo and Vice President, ex-Vice President Pence going there and taking money and, you know, hailing on, you know, this organization? No. They'll go. And does it stop Brad Sherman from taking money and stopping the Boeing sale of planes to Iran? No. So, like I said, it's both parties have, you know, been unfortunately supportive of the Mayim Rajavi. So that's one organization. The other top three organizations that, based on our survey, did not get support is NAIAC. It's the National Iranian American Council. I must say that, you know, they've been around. They're the longest formed organization, the first one that's ever formed in U.S., advocating for causes that are important or impact people of Iran. I've never been a member of NAIAC, but I can tell you that at least initially, they did a lot of good work. Their work came along as they formed when the 9/11 happened, and a lot of the Middle Eastern you know, men had to go and sort of check in, and some were taken in custody. Many Iranians there and other people from other Middle Eastern countries, their funds were frozen, their livelihoods were at stake, and a lot of caring, you know, wealthy Iranians came together and, you know, created an organization where they would be able to put their money and their power and their connection together and get, you know, lawyers that would be able to help these people get freed out of the U.S. custody, or, you know, their accounts to be unfrozen so their livelihoods wouldn't be impacted. So that's why NAIAC was formed initially, is that we realized after about 20, we meaning the Iranian Americans, I wasn't even in California at the time, but the Iranian Americans learned that to be part of the democracy is that you would need to be a participant in that democracy. And for that, you need to have a collective voice that represents you. And while they were busy in D.C., and, you know, they were trying to make themselves known and build relationships. The reason why I came into public knowledge initially was because Obama's deal with Iran, you know, and they were helping to broker that. So obviously, a lot of people who are against the government of Iran and maybe a little bit more, I don't want to say right wing, but maybe a little bit more forceful in their methods. While we all have the same goal, and that goal is for the Islamic regime to cease and disappear, you know, our ways of getting there may be different. And so a lot of, you know, those people who are a little bit more inclined on, harsher stance and harsher, you know, willing to even to go to war with Iran, or enticing United States to go in war with Iran, and unseat this government, were very upset with NIAC for brokering this deal, and they were very upset with President Obama. While the rest of us, we were happy to see diplomacy. We were happy to see that the pressure on ordinary Iranians may be lifted, and Iran's doors would be open to the Western world and, the world economy. And it would be just as it was done with Cuba, that after 50 years, that, the doors were open. So as it stands today, while NIAC is still active and, utilizing 20-some years of their experience and efforts, they do carry a very negative aura with them, especially last year with the Woman Life Freedom. There was a lot of attack on NIAC, and part of it is questioning certain talks, why they are, when the ensemble from the regime come, why is it that they are present there and eating lunches and having events and all of these things. So perception can be reality. Maybe it is reality. I'm not here to authenticate or negate them. I'm just informationally trying, as you had requested, trying to differentiate how the organizations are.
So thank you. Yes.
So the other big organization that I, touched on before is PAIA, or Public Alliance of Iranian American, I think that's an alliance or something like that. And so they are also based in D.C. They're nonpartisan. I hear some of the people who originally were part of the original mission of NIAC, and then when it, ventured into international affairs, and they really wanted to stay focused on domestic matters, stuff that laws that in the United States could impact the Iranian American community, or like the Muslim ban and that kind of stuff. So they were formed, I want to say, around 15 years ago, and they've done good work as well. There are, again, those fraction of hardcore cyber army type of Iranian opposition people that come out and, they say NIAC 1.0, NIAC 2.0, NIAC 3.0. So anyone that is not necessarily in their camp playing the same harp, and then they put everyone else into the same bucket and try to sort of create havoc. But I think each of these organizations are very focused on the mission. They're very transparent. They're very open for new people to join, whether it's on the board or it is on their committee. So, again, I think the key is that all of the opposition has the same goal, and the goal is for the theocracy in Iran to give its way to a secular democracy. And talking about being in this space, Iranian American Democrats of California was formed About 3 years ago, we went to the San Francisco Democratic Convention, and there was, you know, a lot of talk about war with Iran and all that. This was, unfortunately, the Trump era. And so I designed a shirt that said Iranian Americans Against War, and seven of us that we were all Iranians from Orange County wore those T-shirts to the convention. And it was the best thing that we did because so many other people came. Either they said, I'm Iranian-American or I'm half Iranian-American, and or I know someone, wait here, we'll go and bring some, I have friends who are active. And we came to find out there was at least 20 of us at the convention that we didn't know each other, but we all within our own communities have been active and, you know, we're learning the ropes and learning how to be part of this party and make sure that we have a seat at the table. So with that, we followed up with the next convention in Long Beach, and we all got together and said that, you know, we are not able to add another caucus to the Democratic Party because they have quite a few caucuses as it is, but we could form our own organization in California and apply for an affiliation, to be an affiliated organization with the Democratic Party, which is how the birthplace of IADC was, and we, our inauguration was actually an event we did for stopping the recall for Governor Newsom, and we were our Attorney General Bonta was our special guest, and that's where it was sort of our coming out. We had been working for about a year before that on the bylaws and the organization setup and, you know, getting the word out to active people. So, as I said, IADC is a statewide organization. We are an affiliated organization of the Democratic Party of California. So, obviously, we are partisan, but wherever there are issues or ideas that are being introduced, no matter whether it's introduced by a Republican or a Democrat or an independent, we're there to be a voice for the people of Iran, Iran and Iranian community. We don't claim to represent everyone, but based on the poll that we have done and our research and the diverse background of the people who are on IADC's board, we try to be a fair representation of the Iranian community.
I'm not abdicating my role as host here, but I'm thinking I just got out of Sudi's way so she could give us this whole layered affiliation of Iranian Americans with Iran. And it's a heck of a quiz to pass to get all this. But the NIAC endorsements were the very dicey kinds of endorsements for some candidates in the California races going into the primary that people had to be very clear about something. That NIAC might have given an endorsement that the candidate didn't seek, so it was sort of an additional kind of conundrum for candidates to sort of associate with the very affiliations they preferred. So that was very tricky stuff. So my guest, if you just joined us, is Sudi Farokhnia, a local risk and audit professional, and you were here talking about the Iranian American Democrats of California, IADC, that she talks about in shorthand, talking about those many, many affiliations around the U.S., especially in California. I just, if you could give me a quick sort of answer before we go into some of this pending legislation, is if you had a stack of dollars, so would you, I wonder if, let's say that what the Iranian American Democrats of California have in the way of assets to work with versus what NIAC in California has to work with. If there's a way to sort of understand what kinds of resources are, it may be a little bit asymmetric, no?
First of all, while individual members of IADC have been in politics, you know, collectively,
yes.
For many years, the organization has only been around for 3 years, and it for the community to get to know us, you know, it takes time. That's why we are present at a lot of Iranians and non-Iranian events. You know, we're tabling, we're talking to people And, you know, right now we have 100 paid members, like 102 or 103 paid members. And that's pretty good for, you know, 3 years that we've been around. Mm-hmm. But like last year, our intake was less than $40,000. Those were all donations by the community or the membership fees that people are paying. And much of it is funded, as we always say. You know, you mentioned earlier that I ran for Central Committee. On Wednesday, last week, I told my mom, "Mom, I won my race." And she said, So what are you now?"
Yeah, right. Yeah, well, that was a big part of the ballot to pick six for those Central Committee members, right?
Yes, exactly. And so I had to explain to her the structure where there is like County Central Committee and then there's State Committee and how they all fold into each other. And then there's also the local clubs, how they roll up
to the
County Central Committee. And she said, So is this something you're going to get paid for?" I'm like, "No, I pay to be in there."
Right. Well, thank you. It's a lot. I really need to hasten us to some of this legislation. Did you have one more point to mention? And I'm talking about the resources that being a bit asymmetric. But did you have?
Well,
let
they
me finish.
Are. And but then there's also, you know, who knows? You know that you know for instance with the Mujahideen, who knows where they're getting all this money? You know, their compound in Albany is, you know, state of the art. Like a museum, so they have a, you know, non-army militia basically trained in Albany. So all of that takes money, and they're not necessarily working. They're there, so there are. I'm sure here, even I know, like in Newport Beach, there has been fundraisers for them at, you know, one of the wealthy residents who seems to be aligned with them. But I don't think that would be enough for that. So there is also these talks about Saudi Arabia, which has been generally an arch rival of the Islamic regime, that they have been funding this. Some people say, you know, there are others who are funding it. Who knows? There's always these accusations. But what I know is that they're not based in, or you know, in U.S. But for all the other organizations that are based in U.S., you can go online and you can easily find out who were all the donors, for instance, to IADC, and how we spend our money, what our expenditure was. These are required reporting FEC. And so I think the people who perhaps fan the propaganda are just unaware and uneducated. And so I find it to be that, you know, IDC is very focused on educating, engaging, and empowering. And the education part is very important to be able to engage the community, for them to trust democracy, to vote, and to, just like us, become engaged in, you know, the politics. And the empowering part is really for them to run for office. Okay. Because we have, you know, as a community, I'm not trying to be elitist or anything, but as general, we have a very highly educated, a lot of people in innovations, and well-to-do or very people with inspiring minds just don't know how to get involved. And we're hoping that we would be that vehicle that helps people understand how to get started.
Thank you. We really need to push through a few legislative measures here. Thank you for that.
Sure.
So the shorthand is MENA. It's the Middle Eastern Northern African Inclusion Act. It's also known as the Assembly Bill 2763. It's a California measure. It's not national, but it deals with how people identify where census data is collected. So how would it work for federal? Well, we've just explained that it provides another demographic that allows for a more accurate demographic distinction for someone on a census. But how would it work SUDI for federal requirements and programs. And the intention is this to be a template that might move into a larger national adoption of including Middle Eastern Northern African identities on a census.
Yeah, well, actually, it's the other way around. So the Office of Management and Budget, actually, in the national scale, Congress is not involved in this. It's the OMB that is involved,
okay.
The Office of Management and Budget. And so they, for 2 years, have been working on adding that because in the last two censuses, Iranian Americans and, you know, Middle Easterns from all, you know, different origins have really been pushing that including Middle East as in the white is inaccurate for several reasons. While this originally would, it comes from the idea that we used to have Caucasians, right? And, you know, Caucasus is in the Middle East. You know, we used to be part of Iran. Now, it's north, west of Iran. But so the idea was Caucasian, so therefore the Middle Easterns are also Caucasian. But then they changed their, you know, place of origin and, you know, sort of race altogether and made it white. And then it said Middle Easterns are going to be part of that. Well, you know, the everyday experience of the Middle Easterns in the United States is that we're not necessarily seen as white or treated as white. So there's not a good distinction there. We are definitely a minority organ, and based on the last census, it seems to be 1% of the overall population of the United States were specifically identified to be from three countries, Iran, Egypt, and Lebanon. And obviously there are many other Middle Eastern countries, including Israel, that have, you know, residents in the United States or they're citizens of the United States. So therefore, the push has been for MENA, and over 30,000 testimonies were collected by OMB. And so we're expecting in July timeline for OMB to announce on the federal level whether all the federal applications, not just census, but all federal applications would be updated to include MENA as a place of origin. So then California also is following suit. In California, however, our state capital would need to vote on that. So this bill being introduced by Assemblymember Asai Lee is to do that, to make sure that all the capital, so it's kind of going parallel with the federal.
Okay, thank you for
to
that.
To make sure that MENA is in there.
Thank you for that distinction. And I'm looking at that when you were sharing at the Great American Write-In, and I'm looking for references to OMB, and it's not there. So, but this is really helpful for us to think, because I know a lot of people that are involved with, it's not just the census. There's so many other data collection opportunities where we're all just floundering, like, whoa, we're not capturing who this person is with me that is responding to this, where it will result in, you know, needs being met and languages being included and all kinds of things. So so that's one of the legislative pieces. Then there, in really, really short order, because we're going to find out we're not going to get everything covered here, the Temporary Family Visitation Act, it sprang from, I believe, the Muslim travel ban from the previous administration. Talk about where that legislation is and what people need to know. Sudi.
Yeah. So it's the H.R. 5155, and it has bipartisan support both in the House and in the Senate. It has also folded under another bill that Representative Salazar had introduced, which is called the Dignidad or Dignity Act. It became part of a bigger act, which is an Immigration Reform Act as well. So both of those acts have, you know, multiple sponsors,
okay.
Bipartisan sponsors. And what it's trying to do is to introduce a new visa category, B3, which will allow for, you know, there is a backlog. I tell people, my brother is a citizen of Germany, has children and wife in Germany, and he's been waiting 14 months now to get a visa to come just to visit us.
just to visit, folks. This is family occasions, family milestones, including someone's death.
Exactly. And he's had 2 5-year visas in the past, so it's not like he hasn't been to the United States before. He has no intention of coming and staying in the United States, but he's missing all these occasions, you know, and our mother is elderly, and so for him to be able to, at the drop of a hat, be able to come and be on our, you know, on the side of my mom,
yes,
is very important to us.
Yes.
But it hasn't happened. And there's many other stories like this. You know, there is a baseball player who was from the Colombian, I believe, background, and he was being abducted into the Hall of Fame, and he really wanted his mother to be able to take part in that. She couldn't make it because of the backlog of visa. Obviously, the mother doesn't have any intention of coming and staying here all her life if she's lived there. But so this B3 is saying, okay, for people who apply for this, they can come and stay only up to 90 days. They can never change status, which means that, you know, they can't come and they can't have any incentive of coming and overstaying and then thinking that then they would apply for other type of immigrant position. So that's what the TFVA or Temporary Family Visa Act is hoping to do, and we are hoping to get more support in Congress to advance this bill.
Very important. And so is there any kind of how far is this coming along? How likely?
It's coming along. I mean, see, the thing is that, you know, I need to remind everyone,
yes,
that we have last year with this 118th Congress was the worst of the do-nothing Congress ever in the history of the United States. Like, the lowest number of bills that were ever passed through Congress in the past was about 310 or something. Last year was only 27. And some of those bills that passed were like
continuing resolution, just business, just housekeeping.
Resolution, renaming some park in Minnesota or things like that. So it is very hard while the people on the ground and, you know, people, staff, are really working, and much of these bills are part of relationship. You don't just send it to somebody's office and they say, oh, okay, thank you, looks good. They get thousands of requests for support. So you have to actually schedule meetings, have several conversations, answer questions before you are able to get an office of a senator or a representative to support a bill. So that effort, it's continuing, but whether it's going to be picked up and goes through a committee and, you know, what they call the process of write-up to see if there's any amendments required in it, and then whether the Speaker of the House actually brings that bill to the floor for a vote. There's, like, so many hurdles you need to pass through. I would say, like, today is like Charshamba 3. We jump over fire. There's a lot of bonfires we got to jump over.
Right. So, and maybe I really need to race us through a little bit more here, but I just want to say that, so perhaps there is a matter of so-called partisan branding. If this is considered not, like, right on the brand of the immigration kind of dogma that the party in barely in the majority in the House of Representatives could sort of just have very little incentive to keep this moving through. And so to the detriment of family members around the whole world, every continent covered, depriving them of a really very meaningful come together for whatever reasons.
Right on.
I mean, that's the damage. Yeah, I'm sorry.
That is the damage. And you actually, that partisan party-line dogma actually comes into a little bit of a play, not
yes,
a little, quite a bit of a play, in getting support for the Allyship Act.
That's the next one, H.R. 6865, introduced also in the 118th Congress last year. So, yes,
correct,
the objectives there.
Yes. So this was introduced by our own Representative Barbara Lee in December of 2023. So it's the newest of the bills that has been introduced. It's just trying to get traction right now.
Okay.
It is the first of its kind of a bill because there were a little over 20 bills and resolutions introduced last year that had something to do with Iran. They were all about accountability and putting maximum pressure on the Islamic regime. While we agree that the regime needs to be held accountable, we also understand that much of these embargoes and all that is really, really, you know, the sanctions is really affecting everyday people's lives in Iran. And there we found that there was a hole where there was not even one bill introduced that was focused on how to help the people of Iran while holding the government also accountable. So one of the things that in Allyship Act has six parts to it. One of the parts in there is talking about people in the Woman Life Freedom Movement. As you may have heard that on Friday, on International Women's Day, the UN's fact-finding mission on Iran that was formed last year came up with their annual report and founding, and they stated that the Islamic Republic violent repression of peaceful dissent and severe discrimination against women and girls in Iran has been confirmed as constituting nothing short of crimes against humanity. So knowing that so many people were targeted right in their eye, and they are young people who have lost their eye or, you know, lost other limbs, one of the things in this allyship bill is to give opportunity of parole for because these people have served in a prison, you know, at times. And generally, through the immigration process, they ask, you know, have you ever been in prison? And it really makes it hard for those people to be able to seek any sort of a settlement in the United States. So one of them is to, you know, the Office of the President and the Immigration have discretion on giving parole to in special circumstances where, you know, we know it's a matter of oppression. Well, you know, I'm not going to name who the Republican is because I'm hoping that now they would come to support this. But at the time, we had a lot of discussion. We wanted this bill to come out with a bipartisan support. And because the, you know, the narrative of the Republican Party was that they wanted to take parole capabilities away from the executive branch, that she wasn't able, as much as she loved the bill, she wasn't able to support this bill because it would go against the party line, you know, the party language. Well, then the border/funding bill got introduced in the Senate, which obviously it got killed by the presidential hopeful Trump, and the concept of taking the parole away from the office of, you know, executive office was not part of that bill. So obviously the Republican Party changed their tune on that. And so we're hoping as these discussions go on and, you know, that, you know, matters, the party line matters are settled, that we would be able to get more support for the allyship. And I just want you to know that Temporary Family Visa Act was introduced in the prior Congress and they, you know, got some pushback and it was revised and reintroduced and got a lot of support this time. And we anticipate the Allyship Act may be the same as well, knowing that it's an election year and there is election politics involved and not that many bills are coming to the floor for votes right now. It's unlikely the Allyship Act will come to a vote, but understanding the concept and getting sponsors for it will help, hopefully, for it to be, you know, become a law, you know, a signed bill in the next Congress after the election.
So it's important to frame here the kind of collateral damage in the dogma of a sort of one-size-only sort of immigration approach in the American political arena, that this Allyship Act looks like a real opportunity for some soft power in not just Iran, but beyond, but this, that soft power opportunity is straitjacketed from this dogma of what immigration policy means in the party in barely control in the House of Representatives.
Correct. You're on. And I want to give you a good news one. You know, there is a, you know, as you said, Nowruz is upon us. Nowruz being there means a new day. It would be on March 19th at 8:06 p.m. is when the Earth has done a full circle around the sun. So it's based on the solar calendar, and it is celebrated by 300 million people around the world in many countries, from Iran, Afghanistan, Tajikistan, in that area. And there are others who live in other countries who are supportive of that. And while in the Congress, Nowruz has been recognized as a, you know, as a holiday, not a national holiday, but as a, you know, ethnic holiday. In California, it was first introduced by Assembly Member Nazarian, who's now running for a city council in L.A. But then again, we were lucky enough that Senator Wahab, Aisha Wahab, who's from the Northern California and the first African-American to be elected
East Bay.
In California.
It's in East Bay, right? Oakland, Berkeley?
Yes.
Yes, indeed. That was a big deal. Yes.
Yes. She's amazing. So she introduced the Nowruz resolution last year. We were there. IEDC was present in Sacramento for that merry occasion. And one of our members, Nayam Azhar, who is now also the president of IEDC, she and another one of our steering committee members, Mona Shushtari, were last year sort of celebrated as Women of the Year by their own assembly members. And so they were there and they set up a HAP scene, which is our celebratory spread, sort of think of a Christmas tree of Nowruz.
Yes.
But it's not a tree. It's actually a spread that has seven items, starting with the letter S. And there's a whole story of it. If anyone wants to Google HAP scene, they will know more about what each of these symbols mean. But this year, also IEDC, you know, wrote a resolution and proposed it to Senator Wahab, and she will be introducing that next week at the State Senate. And we will be there again. Also, IEDC will be there to, one, host Nowruz gathering for those that celebrate Nowruz and work in Sacramento. Plus, we will have a half scene at the Rotunda. Plus, you know, celebration, you know, that Afghans do for Nowruz, which is a little bit different than the Iranians. And then also we learned just recently that Assembly Member Jesse Gabriel has also introduced a Nowruz resolution. He's in San Fernandino, and he's like that's Encino, Van Nuys area that has a high concentration of Iranian Americans who live there. So next week in Sacramento would be...
We have just for one more. We have less than a minute here to wrap the celebration.
Yeah.
Thank you.
I'm just saying that, you know, both in Washington, D.C. and in Sacramento, there would be celebration for Nowruz. In my place of work that I'm working right now today, I have a half team set up here with 3,000 employees. And we will be serving a Persian cuisine buffet that I came last week and teach it to our chefs. So I'm eager to see how good of a students these chefs are.
Okay.
And how they pull together this Persian buffet. So we can all, no matter where we are, whether it's the place of work, in our communities, you know, in the library,
yes,
everywhere, we would be able to bring the message of Nowruz and the spring is coming.
Well, Nowruz Mubarak, thank you so much for your time today on Ask a Leader, Suri Farokhnia.
Thank you so much for having me.
Suri is a audit and finance specialist. And she's also a member of the, as you've heard her talk about, the co-founder of the Iranian American Democrats of California. Well, that's my wrap. Next week, my guests will be Cornelia Spellman, social worker and author, to talk about her latest project, Introducing Logic to Very Young Readers. And we'll hear from Jennifer Backhouse, founder and artistic director of Backhouse Dance, in advance of her company's return to Irvine Barclay Theater on Wednesday, March 27th at 8 p.m. Talk with you next week, and thank you, everyone, for listening.
Ay yarım ya, el yarım ya, sort of